I'm not going to ask for any, for now. It takes a moment for his words to sink in. She did not see that coming. She thought 5 months as a single parent would have Greg begging for joint custody at best. So, you're asking for... I'm not asking for anything, Pauline. I'm telling you, okay? You left your daughter. I've done just fine. You probably didn't think I could, but it turns out it's not as hard as you always made it out to be. I don't know, maybe you're just not cut out to be a mother. She needs him to spell it out, wants him to say exactly what he wants. But if I decided I wanted visitation, if you want it. But it's been 5 months and you haven't visited once. But she has in her own way. She has sneaked into Baltimore every chance she has, using Adam's truck or taking the Peter Pan bus. I don't have a car, and now you're selling the one I do have. See, that's all you can think about, the car. You have a kid, Pauline. You left her. This is indisputable, but there are, as Greg's lawyer would undoubtedly write, mitigating factors. The postcards. Did she get my postcards? She has sent one every week since Greg found her at the Hi-Ho. True, they were only scrawled hearts and I love yous, but it's not like a 3-year-old can read. A pause. She knows that pause. It's the pause that always followed certain questions. Questions that Greg found inconvenient. Where were you last night? Did you remember to get the things I needed from the store on your way home? First a pause, then a lie. No, he says. I thought it would confuse her. It has the ring of truth, which throws her off more than anything else in this conversation. She's only 3, he continues. She can't read. She didn't want postcards. She wanted you. And you never came. No argument there. She says, I know I'm the one who said no lawyers, but if you insist on full custody, then don't, Pauline. His voice is infuriatingly kind. I'm not going to pay you for the privilege of keeping our kid. You've got your freedom, which is clearly what you wanted. I'm not going to give you money on top of it. You think that's how I am? I know, okay? I know everything, Pauline. It feels as if her heart rises up her throat, all the way to her teeth. If he's found out about the settlement, then everything, everything she's done is for nothing. She's been told he has no legal rights, but she doesn't want to spend a penny fighting to keep what's hers. And Greg will fight for money. No, what? It came out in the papers over here. You're a killer who's already lost custody of one kid, then got a second chance. Well, you had it. Maybe the third time will be the charm for you. This us, we're over. Close to being over, she thinks. So close. But then, every time she thinks she's close to the end, something else happens. Another bump in the road. Okay, she says. Now she knows exactly what he wants. Wasn't that Barry Forshaw's advice? Trick Greg into revealing what he wants, and then you'll have true leverage. Greg wants Janny. He's probably bluffing, but maybe he thinks that's the only way he gets the other stuff. He's expecting her to counter. She wins by not doing what he expects. Still, she can't help allowing herself one little zinger. You can't rely on your mother for childcare forever, you know. Who said I was? I just assumed that's what you were doing. Fact is, I found a really good daycare center near the office last week. Interesting. Greg always said daycare wasn't right. That it was for welfare mothers, or people who didn't really love their kids. Are you dating? She asks. Pauline. Kind. Beseeching. As if he thinks the information could hurt her. You're entitled, she adds. There's a woman at work, but she's more of a friend. She has a little boy, about Janny's age. Greg has never had a female friend. Greg doesn't believe in female friends. They specifically had that argument after watching When Harry Met Sally on video one night, with him maintaining that real men didn't have female friends. That's nice for you. She tries to think of what a normal woman would say in this situation, a woman who's not trying not to conceal how much she wants a man out of her life, how much she loathes him. Do the kids like each other? Pretty well. Look, Pauline, yes? Whatever happens, we'll make it work, Greg says. She wonders who the we is. Greg and her, Greg and his mother, Greg and Janny, Greg and his friend. But that's secondary. He has established his terms. She knows what he wants, what he's willing to give. Could I get this in writing? She asks. The financial stuff? Have your lawyer draw up something based on what we talked about today, about the property, and I'll sign it. Have it notarized, if that's what it takes. But then we'll be on our way, just the financial stuff, though. Polly also knows what she wants, and what she's willing to do to get it. She swallows hard, dials Barry Forshaw Collect, and tells him what she needs. He asks a lot of pesky questions, complains that it's not really his kind of thing, but in the end, he's happy to do what she wants, for a price. When you help a man make more than $1 million with very little effort, he tends to be kindly inclined toward you. Paper trail commenced. Now she has to mark another kind of trail. Lead the horse to water. Make him drink. That night, when she goes to work, she checks to see if Mr. C really does keep a gun in his desk. Chapter 43. Adam's possessions, the ones he plans to take with him to Belleville, require exactly 11 boxes, 8 of them for books. He could probably live without the books, if it comes to that, but they're easy to box. And they are the only objects, along with his mother's paintings, about which he allows himself to be sentimental. Half the books belong to his parents, his mother's art and photography books, the old man's biographies and histories. He will build a shelf for them in Polly's place. Not some college kid thing made out of plywood and cinder blocks. Not some prefab IKEA shelf. He will build a real one, borrowing tools from Mr. C, or someone else in town. His life in Baltimore is almost as neatly packed away as his possessions. The lease on his apartment will end February 1st. Phone and utilities will be turned off then, too. On Christmas Eve, he's going to drop to one knee and ask Polly to marry him. So why not cancel his apartment by December 31st? Because I'm not sure what she's going to say. When he's in his soon-not-his apartment, he checks 2-3 times a day to make sure that the blue velvet box is safe in its hiding place. He goes to look at it again now, nestled inside a box of tampons that some woman left behind. He's not even sure who. Someone gambling that she was going to be spending more time with him than she ever did, that's for sure. Since Adam's marriage ended, he's never come close to living with anyone. A month, maybe 2. Was the most time he put in with a woman. Then Irving Lowenstein hires him to follow Pauline Hansen, and the next thing he knows is that he's in love with Polly Costello, a woman who killed one man, walked out on another. But he's the one who almost got her killed. He can't forget that. Maybe he shouldn't ask her to marry him until he's man enough to tell her that. Irving's lawyer keeps calling at him, asking him to come see him in the city lockup where he's being held without bail. The lawyer leaves a message every 3 days or so. Irving Lowenstein would like to see you. Checking back to see if you'd like to visit Mr. Lowenstein. I've identified you as a contractor for my firm, so you don't have to worry about filling out a visitor's application. You'll be treated as an employee of the firm. Adam has nothing to say to that snake. He owes him nothing. Sure, he felt guilty last summer when he fell in love with Polly, but he still did right by Irving. Irving Lowenstein, teller of tall tales, pretending that a vulnerable woman ripped him off, preyed on kids, when he's the one who was trying to kill her all along. It is December 21st, a Thursday. That means Christmas falls on a Monday this year. A nice 3-day weekend for regular folks who won't even notice how many other people still have to work December 25th. Cops, firefighters, waiters at Chinese restaurants. And there's not even Chinese food in Belleville. Adam bets the only thing open December 25th will be the Royal Farms near the soon-to-be bypass. Belleville is beautiful at Christmas, and he has never found it more cloying. It has a real It's a Wonderful Life vibe. And It's a Wonderful Life is only the most depressing movie ever made. Work your whole life, be good, and maybe your friends will save you. Except, they probably won't. And every small town is Pottersville in the end. He decides he won't take his books to Belleville on this trip. Or his other boxes. It'll look presumptuous. Even if he and Polly did live together for part of the fall. Going forward, things between them will be stated, out in the open. He will tell her that he was hired as a private investigator to follow her. That he never knew Irving was trying to harm her. If she forgives him, he'll ask her to marry him. That said, there's no law. He has to wait until Christmas Eve to propose. She'll be looking for something then. Why not do it tonight? No one expects a proposal on December 21st. Polly doesn't even expect him to be there. When he'd first told her he didn't think he could get away until Saturday afternoon at the earliest, they both agreed that it might be better for him to drive over Sunday morning, as the roads would be wretched that afternoon. But he's been to the bank, deposited his checks for his last two gigs, and there's not a lot of work this time of year. His last job, in fact, was so awful it made him want to quit PI work forever. Some poor woman with 5 kids, shopping at the Dollar Tree, was hit by a car, all her cheap little presents scattering in the wind. No one was at fault. It was dark. She stepped off a curb, and the tortured good citizen behind the wheel immediately established a fund in her name. But the sister who stepped up to take donations on the kid's behalf turned out to be completely shifty. The driver called Adam, and Adam sussed it out in less than 2 days. The woman, under a slightly different name, had several penny ante convictions, bad checks, stealing some stuff from a roommate, real people's court shit. There was no way she should be overseeing that fund. But the part that soured Adam on his job was the happy client giving him a bonus for scaring the shit out of the shady sister. It was as if her misdeeds cleared the slate for the poor mope, made him feel less guilty about the accident. True, she'd probably skimmed some money off the donations that came in, but there was still almost $5,000 for the 5 kids, which will help. It won't send them to college, but it will buy groceries, keep the heat on. $5,000 is a lot of money. It's almost enough to buy a canary yellow engagement ring. Shit. He's approaching the bridge and he's left the ring behind. Should he take that as a sign? Maybe he should wait until the new year. Maybe he should wait until she's legally divorced. That letter, why didn't she read it in front of him? He knows Maryland law, and he realizes she can't initiate the divorce, not for a while. If her husband doesn't file, she has to wait 2 years for a no fault. 2 years. June 1997. Where will they be? Who will they be? He takes the last exit before the bridge and heads back. It'll cost him almost 90 minutes, but he can't stop thinking about it. It is almost 9 Thursday night when Adam reaches the Hi-Ho. But the bar is packed. Business picks up during the holidays. People get giddy from all the socializing, want to keep going. And the Hi-Ho is one of the few places open after 8. Mr. C has put up decorations that appear to be 50 years old, right out of that Christmas story movie. Strands of multicolored lights, an illuminated wreath in one window. The air inside the bar feels overheated and smoky after even a few seconds of the cold, crisp air in the parking lot. Adam's eyes need a moment to adjust. Mr. C is tending bar. Where's Polly?
She wasn't expecting you tonight, Adam. I wanted to surprise her.
Oh, I think we have a gift of the magic here, says Mr. C, mangling the name of the old O. Henry story. Polly asked for today off, for a mystery errand. I assume it's for you. The thing she was making for you is not coming out so good. She said there was something she needed to pick up in Baltimore and she took the bus. But you weren't supposed to be here until early Sunday, I thought.
I was trying to surprise her, Adam mutters, taking a stool. Might as well have a beer or two.
Like I said, gift of the magic.
He doesn't have the heart to correct Mr. C's repeated malapropism, explain that the story is correctly called The Gift of the Magi, and that it's more than two people trying to surprise each other. It's the catch-22 of gift-giving. It's also another one of those Christmas stories that everyone thinks is so nice, when it's depressing as hell. Two desperately poor people try to do something nice for each other as Christmas approaches, sacrificing their most cherished possessions. The woman's hair may grow back, but it will never be quite the same. Women's hair never is after they cut it. And what do you do with a watch fob when you don't have a watch? What do you do with an engagement ring when you don't have your girl? When did she say she was coming back? Adam asks.
She didn't. Doesn't matter, because she asked for today and tomorrow off, and we're closed Christmas Eve and Christmas.
She didn't tell me she was off. Mr. C clapped a hand to his mouth.
Maybe that's part of the secret.
Adam goes to her garage apartment, soon to be theirs. Senseless to expect her, as no buses run this late. But he keeps hoping she'll slide in next to him. But she doesn't come home that night. Or the next day. Or that night. When Saturday, December 23rd, dawns, and there's still no sign of her. Adam can't stop lying to himself. Something is wrong, terribly wrong. And there's only one person who can assure him that Polly is okay. Chapter 44. Merry Christmas, Irving says to Adam over the low partition at City Jail. Don't be funny, Adam says.
What a sad world this is, when even a polite greeting is suspect.
I'm glad to see you, if surprised by the timing. I guess it's a good thing that my lawyer listed you as one of the firm's employees. Can't have been easy getting in here on the Saturday before Christmas. A friendly judge made it happen. Your lawyer's very well connected.
I would hope so, Irving says. My legal affairs are not a place to cut corners. I always hire the best.
Or try. Lowenstein looks terrible. At least 10 years older than he did when Adam last saw him face to face, which was in June. The orange jumpsuit is unkind to most complexions, but Irving looks particularly haggard. The blood vessels in his face are more prominent, his eyes rheumy like an old dog's. He has a cold, but no handkerchief. And keeps honking into the crook of his elbow. His cough is syrupy, almost a gurgle.
You've been trying to talk to me since you were arrested. Why?
I had information that I thought you should have.
About Polly?
Is someone still after Polly? Are you still trying to kill her?
Irving needs a beat.
It's funny. I still think of her as Pauline, but then, in my head, she still has short blonde hair and is a little overweight. Zaftig is the better word. It's Yiddish. It means, I know what Zaftig means.
They say almost no one can maintain a significant weight loss.
But she has, hasn't she? Still skinny, almost 5 years out.
Maybe prison can be a kind of spa, if you treat it right. I can look forward to that, at least, if I'm convicted.
You'll be convicted.
Adam waits for Irving to contradict him. Does the case against Irving rely on Polly's testimony? It occurs to Adam that he hasn't really thought too much about the evidence against Irving, what the cops have. If Polly is the key witness and Polly is missing, where is she?
Pauline? I'm sure I don't know.
You tried to kill her before.
Really?
You may have noticed I'm not charged with that particular crime. They can't even put me at the scene. I flew to Toledo that morning to visit my daughter. In fact, I've never been to Belleville, Delaware.
Adam had assumed that Delaware charges would follow after Marilyn was through with Lowenstein. But of course Lowenstein has never been to Belleville.
You never do your own dirty work. You hired me to keep tabs on her. Then you hired another guy to use the information I had gathered, tried to make the death look like an accident. When they find him, it will be a race to see who flips on who first.
They're never going to find him, Irving says, because he doesn't exist.
You wanted her dead.
I do now.
The simple words chill him.
What have you done, Irving?
Where is she?
He shakes his head, his face serious, but without malice. The graveness of his expression worries Adam even more. He would feel better if he sneered or laughed mirthlessly, like some cartoon villain.
I hold no brief for her. But I never tried to kill her. What, you think I'm some criminal mastermind? Orchestrating things from city jail? I'm a grandfather. Near retirement.
The case against me is based on Pauline's say-so and a collection of, let's say, inconveniently coincidental policies I helped to broker years ago. Yes, if she doesn't testify, I have a better chance at acquittal, but I've never arranged a hit on anyone.
He seems to lose himself in a memory before he repeats more firmly, I never tried to kill anyone.
And yet people ended up dead because of you. How many? And what would one more mean?
I know you're here as a contractual hire of my lawyer, Lowenstein says. But I'm not going to presume confidentiality.
I put my trust in you once. I won't make that mistake again.
You put your trust in me. You lied to me again and again, claiming she had money, that she had ripped you off, that she had stolen from one kid and she would do it again. You were biding your time, waiting for the perfect moment to try and kill her.
I knew where she was before I hired you, Sonny. The point was to figure out if she had money, if she was spending it. Now it's 6 months later, you're just a poor schmendrick who fell in love with her.
Is it possible you know even less about her than you did when you started?
Oh, you know the names, the sad history, her crime. You know she had a daughter with Dittmars. Do you know what happened to her?
I assume some relative took her in.
No one wanted that kid. Joy Dittmars has a severe form of cerebral palsy, can't walk, can't speak, and is institutionalized at Mount Washington Pediatric Hospital. It's on Rogers Avenue. Sound familiar?
Two taxis on a hot summer day. One turns on Rogers Avenue. Adam made the decision not to follow, reasoning that she would spot him on that suburban road. But he told Irving what he saw, where they went. Turns out, Irving knew all along what was on Rogers Avenue.
And here's how canny she is. The life insurance from her first husband, the policy that almost ruined me, got me investigated, that was in her daughter's name, in a trust administered by Pauline. Insurance company wouldn't have to pay if it were for Pauline, but they couldn't keep the money from the daughter.
It pays for her care there. Pauline then surrendered her parental rights, voluntarily. She couldn't get rid of that kid fast enough. But Pauline wasn't done. Oh, no. She likes to play the innocent. But she picked up some tricks from that husband of hers. Last year, she settled out of court with the hospital where the kid was born, blaming them for her condition. Deprivation of oxygen at birth, probably. I'm not sure why the hospital didn't do due diligence about custody. They were probably so excited to settle that they didn't get very far into the investigation. But if the state has the kid, she's not entitled to the damages. I figured she could cut me in for a share, or I'd tell the hospital they'd been taken. But I needed to figure out why she was keeping it a secret. Now I realize it's an asset she's hiding from her next ex-husband. She's a shark, that one, always moving forward. She's the opposite, Adam wants to say. She's been swimming lazy circles in Belleville all these months. I'm telling you, she doesn't have any money. She can barely make rent some months. And you help her with that, don't you? Irving does smile now. But it is an infuriatingly kind one, almost pitying. She has her charms. I know, believe me. There's something about her. A stillness. A capacity for quiet. Maybe she always had that quality, but sometimes I think it was from living with Dittmars. She learned to freeze. Like a deer, or a child playing that game, freeze tag. And she gave a man a sense that he was a hero, that he could save her. If she made me feel that way, I can't imagine what it's been like for you. You had associates, other people who were involved in the things you did. Adam is grasping, and he knows it. But there has to be an explanation for Polly's disappearance. Would he really rather her be dead than duplicitous, playing him for a sucker all these months? Yes, yes he would. Adam, here's one thing you can take to the bank, one thing you already know, if you would just let yourself. I've never killed anyone, not directly. Do I know of deaths? Sure. But I was caught between two vultures. Nothing more than a paper pusher. I've never shoved a knife in a man's heart. She has. And she probably killed that girl, too. The one who died in the explosion. You should know these things. So, you've been calling me out of concern with my welfare these past few weeks? No. But there is something I think you should know. Something that will change everything you think you know about your relationship with this woman. It's a mindfuck, Adam tells himself. He's a bitter old man, and Adam did do him dirty, in a sense. If he hadn't fallen in love with Polly, probably none of this would have happened. Kath's death, Irving's arrest, it's not his fault that Irving sent someone inept to kill Polly. Someone inept. That's the real threat. Irving doesn't have to ask the guy who killed Kath to kill Polly. He'll know to do it on his own. If she's dead, the charges against Irving go away and no one has to flip on anyone. I can't believe anything you have to say. Be that way. I'm still going to give you a little stocking stuffer. Something small to occupy your thoughts. But instead of leaning forward, as most men do when sharing a confidence, he leans back and presses his arm on the table in front of him, almost like someone bracing for an accident. She knows about you. Has for months. Knows what? Knows that you're a private detective and that I hired you. She was pretty slick, I have to admit. Called up, pretending to be a housewife with a cheating husband, checking your references. But you know and I know that I wouldn't have been giving you a very good reference as of August, right? I told my mystery caller that, Per the law on confidential personnel information, I would confirm only the dates of your employment with me, and I did. Can you think of anyone else who would have been thinking of hiring you last summer? Adam hasn't lost his ability to think on his feet. That's not news to me, he tells Irving. Polly and I came clean with each other a long time ago about everything. Oh, so you knew what I told you today about the daughter and the money. Right. All that money is for the daughter. She's never touched it, and she's never going to. He lies for himself, not Irving, and finds the lie credible. That explains everything. There is no money. She is not dishonorable. She found out he had a secret and kept her own, tit for tat. He'll tell her everything, and she'll tell him everything, if he finds her, when he finds her. Assuming she can be found. Well then, Merry Christmas, Irving says. And a Happy New Year. I don't know about you, but I feel cautiously optimistic for 1996. Chapter 45. Polly waits. She sits in the hi-ho Saturday evening, which closed early today and will not open again until Tuesday. She has left the car she's using, a bright red Toyota with Maryland tags, in the lot. From where she's sitting, behind the bar, but to the side, so she has a view through the window, she can see the light on in room 3 at the Valley View. She decided to leave the door unlocked, which is a little risky, but the manager knows where she is if anything happens. Says he'll keep an ear out. But for the first time in almost a year, Polly can admit to herself that she has no idea what's going to happen. Which is not to say that all her careful plans have proceeded as she hoped over the past year. Quite the opposite. She did not foresee how long things would take, that's for sure. She was not prepared for Greg's reactions, the macho posturing of last summer, the sudden dedicated daddy game he's playing now. She did not plan for Adam, for love. No one plans for love, much less decides to love a man she cannot trust. But maybe that will be okay. She can work out the Adam problem later. First, she needs to get through the next few hours. She has left her trail of breadcrumbs, and all she can do is wait and see who comes through the door. The door at which she is aiming Mr. C's gun. The crunch of gravel, the rattle of a doorknob. A man's shape fills the door, backlit by the neon of the Valley View sign. Even in silhouette, she knows him instantly. The shoulders are broad, the posture perfect. Adam. Fuck. She's wrong again. Chapter 46. Polly? Hi, Adam. What are you doing? Working a little overtime? She puts the gun down on the bar. Adam walks over to her. It is 9 o'clock, the eve before Christmas Eve. Christmas Eve's eve. Was it really only 48 hours ago that he thought he would be down on one knee in this spot, asking a woman to marry him? This woman, standing vigil with a handgun, she probably doesn't even know how to use. Whose car is that out front? Mine. Or used to be. But I would think you would know that. I assumed it was in your dossier on me. My dossier? Isn't that what private detectives call their reports? Remember, I didn't go to Oberlin. Only community college, but you knew that, too. You knew where I went to high school, and the dates of my marriages, all that stuff. It must have gotten confusing at times, trying to remember what you were supposed to know and what I hadn't told you yet. He wants to hold her. But there is the bar between them. The bar and the gun.
I'm sorry, he says. There never seemed to be a right time to tell you. Once we were in love. Did it really matter?
I don't know, she says.
I don't have the luxury of thinking about things like that. There are more pressing matters.
Adam looks at the gun on the bar. He remembers thunder and explosion, which came first.
Polly, did you kill Kath? He asks.
What do you think?
I don't know what to think anymore.
That's honest, at least.
She still hasn't answered his question. Where did you go, Polly? Where have you been?
I went to Baltimore.
Greg told me earlier this month that he's going to pursue full custody of Jenny, that he might even expect child support from me. Down the road, although he's waiving it for now, isn't that rich? Of course, he doesn't know that I have money coming to me. That was the whole point, to get out of that marriage before Greg found out about the settlement. I'm guessing you know about that, too. I assume that's why Irving hired you. He heard I had money, he wanted it. And not because he needed it, just to make things hard on me. I get why you don't want your ex to have your money, but if you're not gonna raise your kid, would it be the worst thing in the world to pay support if you can?
You don't get anything.
Her tone is weary, impatient. Come with me. She leads him out of the bar, across the street to room 3. As she opens the unlocked door, he's saying, I don't think this is the time to... Although part of him thinks maybe it's exactly the time. Maybe it's the only thing to do now. Maybe if they make love, he'll remember why he loves her. But the bed already has someone in it. A little girl, with high color in her cheeks and dark, tight curls. It's only seeing the girl, close up, that Adam registers how much she looks like her father, and how much she looks like Adam. He couldn't see that before, but he and Greg bear a strong resemblance to each other. Jenny, Polly says, but again, you know that. You've seen us together, right? He nods at the beach before you left her. I figured I was only going to be gone for a few months, tops. I didn't realize how long things would take. I thought I could get to Reno, get a divorce in 6 weeks. Belleville wasn't part of the plan. Neither were you. I had so many lovely plans. I sure didn't expect her father to fight me for custody. I assumed he'd be going crazy after a few months alone with her, would beg me to take her off his hands. You kidnapped her. She's mine. There's no custody order. No law broken. I took a bus to Baltimore Thursday afternoon, spent the night in the bus station, which was interesting. On Friday, while Greg was at work, I went to the old house, packed up a bag for her, put it in the trunk of the Toyota. I still had my keys, after all. Then all I had to do was let myself in, about 11, when the house was dark, and pick her up. She wasn't even that surprised to find me carrying her. I think she always knew I would come for her. I drove straight to the Valley View, checked in about 1 a.m.
Why did you bring her to the motel instead of our place?
I didn't want to involve you.
It's the first thing she said that doesn't ring true. After all, she was sitting across the street in the dark, with a gun.
Involve me?
Like you said, there's nothing illegal about a mom having her kid. He could call you in for auto theft, I guess, although if your name is on the title, it is.
Then, I don't think the cops can get involved.
But your ex must be going crazy. He shouldn't be. I left a note that I was taking her for Christmas and would bring her back next week.
He had her for all other holidays this year. It's only fair. Adam has never had a kid, but he's pretty sure that sneaking into your estranged husband's house and taking your daughter 2 days before Christmas is guaranteed to make a man crazy. And he's pretty sure that Polly knows that, too. The girl stirs in her sleep. Let's go back to the hi-ho, Polly says. She's a light sleeper. Is that safe, leaving her here? Safe enough. I told the desk clerk to keep an ear out for her, that I had to do some inventory for overtime pay, but that my daughter was sleeping. Her voice positively caresses those last few words. What about the gun? I heard someone pulling up and I got a little scared. But Mr. C keeps his gun in his desk. And you don't do inventory in the dark. They cross the highway, head into the still dark bar. Now they are on the stools, just as he imagined it. Where is the velvet box? Back at their apartment. Still hidden in that little grove of tampons. Maybe that's for the best. This isn't the time for a romantic proposal. Instead of a blue velvet box between them on the bar, there's a gun. Polly, what are you really up to? I'm gonna run, Adam. Possession is 9/10 of the law. I'm gonna disappear with her, make him divorce me in absentia. Once we're divorced, I'll be okay to use my money. With money, I can fight for her. He has rights, Polly. Don't talk to me about his rights. There's already a new woman, with her own kid. I know, Greg. He'll marry her. She'll favor her kid. Then they'll probably have a kid together. And Greg will favor that kid. Janny's a strong little girl. That's why I could risk being away from her for a few months. But she's not strong enough to rely on Greg. No one is that strong. Polly, did you kill Kath? Did you really think I was the kind of woman who would abandon her kid? Because if you believe that of me, you might as well blame me for Kath and anything else. If you already think I'm a monster, I'm not going to persuade you otherwise. There's a flaw in her logic. But Adam is too overwhelmed to nail it, and once again, she has sidestepped the question about Kath. He goes over to the jukebox, tries to remember the selection he pressed not that long ago when they danced here together. Why is it so hard to find this time? Ah, double A, double one. He presses it. Spanky and our gang start to sing. But the notes can't cover the sound of crunching gravel, the bar door being slammed open hard enough so it almost bounces off the wall. You bitch! Greg says from the door, running toward Polly like a linebacker. You crazy sick bitch! Where's my daughter? Polly dives for the gun, bobbling it a bit, and Adam realizes his fears were well placed. She has no idea how to use a gun. It doesn't matter, because before she can do anything, Greg is on her, dragging her to the floor, while she tries to hold on to the weapon with both hands, kicking and flailing, even biting him. The fight between them seems almost intimate, filled with the passion and bitterness that only two former spouses can manage. She never loved Greg. Adam is sure of that, but she definitely hates him now. It's as if Greg is every man who ever hurt her or disappointed her. And Greg, who has no compunction about hitting a woman, fights her on her terms, slapping and scratching and pulling hair. Adam attempts to pull Greg off Polly, succeeds only in loosening one of her hands from the gun. She yanks Greg's hair with her free hand, but no matter how hard she tears at his hair and face, he won't let go. They are tangled together, as if they may never part. Greg has closed his hand over hers. Adam needs to step in to grab the gun. Who has the gun? Where is the gun? June 11th, 2017. Baltimore, Maryland. Polly studies the tomatoes at the farmer's market. It's not even summer officially, which makes these lumpy heirlooms quite suspect. Tomatoes this early? She asks the farmer, an older man. Then she realizes he's probably about her age, late 50s. She never remembers how old she is.
Hothouse, he admits. But just as good.
She's dubious. Still, she sorts through them, looking for two that are ripe and ready. She has Newski's bacon at home, some American cheese. She needs only to pick up a loaf of good bread from the organic baker, a head of Boston lettuce. Janny specifically requested your famous grilled cheese sandwich for lunch today. And Polly seldom says no to either of her daughters. Besides, Janny has just graduated from law school, UB, near the top of her class. How can Polly deny her a grilled cheese sandwich? She asks for so little. This second child has accepted with unfailing good grace that family life has to center on Joy's needs. Janny hasn't found a job yet, but only because she's choosy. No Wall Street, no white shoe firm for passionate Janny. She plans to represent people like her sister, although through a non-profit, not a money-churning personal injury firm. How Janny loves to sneer at the cheesy commercials for such lawyers, the refrigerator magnets they send out with the yellow pages. Polly doesn't have the heart to tell her that it was just such a lawyer who made their life, their little jewel of a house, Joy's ability to live with them, possible. It's not important. Should she get a good cheddar? Adam always said that nothing melts like American cheese. Maybe a mix of the two, though. So you get the best of both worlds. A perfect melt and more flavor. Polly just hopes Janny won't start harping on her new favorite topic, Polly dating. While Janny seemed to appreciate having Polly's attention focused on her and Joy all these years, she is suddenly intent on pairing Polly up with someone, anyone. She talks about Match.com and eHarmony and the lonesome law professor who looks a little bit like Ichabod Crane but is so funny. Polly doesn't even bother to tell Janny that she has no idea who Ichabod Crane is. She says only, "I'm happy, honey. I can't be any happier. I had a true love once upon a time. And that's more than most people can say." Janny assumes that true love was her father, Greg. Why wouldn't she? Stories are like dough. Did Adam tell Polly that? No, but it sounds like something he would have said. Put your hands in your stories. Work them, but don't overwork them. Polly has always told Janny that the summer of 1995 was a rough patch. She ran away. She took a job in a small Delaware town, took up with another man. I never expected things to end the way they did. Who can contradict her story? 14 years ago, when Janny was only 11, her father was executed for the murder of Adam Bosk. Greg always insisted it was an accident, that Polly was the one who grabbed the gun, fired the fatal shot. But there was the convenient fact of that restraining order she had started to pursue, via Barry Forshaw, only 2 weeks earlier. The belated police report on Greg's attempt to stalk her back in July. Polly feared Greg. He was dangerous. The record showed that. But Adam wasn't supposed to be there. He wasn't due until Christmas Eve. 22 years ago, when almost no one had a cell phone or email, there were gaps and mysteries in communication. He'd said he wouldn't be in Belleville until Sunday morning. She had no reason to doubt that. And the fact is, Greg probably wouldn't have been found guilty of a capital crime if he had shot Polly instead of Adam. When a husband kills his estranged wife, it's just love gone wrong. When he kills the handsome bystander who's trying to break up the fight, that's when things get serious. A month later, Polly, looking for a tampon, found the jewelry box that Adam had hidden. When she had the ring appraised, she was tempted to sell it, but she couldn't bear to part with it. She has never worn it. She keeps it in a safe deposit box for the day when Janny falls in love.
She hopes against hope that Jenny will pick a good man. For her part, Jenny insists she'll never marry. Jenny says she has to be responsible for Joy's care when Polly is gone. But neither Polly nor Joy wants Jenny to live that way, to see her sister as a burden that requires swearing off earthly pleasures. Joy is a joy, everybody's favorite, the heart of the family, a truly old soul. Now 36, she communicates with an iPad, and it amazes Polly how funny she can be, her gift for wordplay and poetry. It makes no sense, but Joy, whose movement is limited in every sense of the word, reminds Polly of Footloose Adam. She's just so very present day to day. And it was proven long ago that Joy doesn't need Polly. It's Polly who needs Joy. Besides, Polly can't imagine being gone. She will live forever. That's her curse. She's indestructible. She is she. She is the leech woman. Only unlike the leech woman, Polly killed another woman and lived. She was going to confess to Adam about Kath, eventually. She believed he would understand once he had all the facts. And she would have left Irving out of the whole mess if Kath's brother-in-law could have stopped sniffing around. It was just another story that Polly had to work without overworking. She knew things about Irving, true. He had hired a private detective to follow her, true. The fire in her apartment was exactly like one Dittmars had set years ago, true. A fire she had heard them plotting. Not so true, but she was willing to perjure herself on that one detail. There was no injustice in locking up Irving Lowenstein for a crime from which he did profit. But it never came to that. Irving Lowenstein had a fatal heart attack a few weeks before his much-delayed trial. Everyone is dead, except Polly. She had yearned to tell Adam everything, if only to test his love for her. But to do that, she would have been forced to share the worst parts about her marriage to Dittmars, the most shaming details, how she knew of his crimes, the people he had killed, but did nothing, until she came to believe he would harm her and Joy. How he liked to take her curling iron and hold it against her flesh, demanding that she not scream, teaching her resilience until she learned to stay silent, even when he gave her a third-degree burn on her thigh. How with increasing frequency toward the end, he would choke her during sex. And she liked it, not because being deprived of oxygen heightened her pleasure, as Dittmars claimed it would, but because, for a few moments, she allowed herself the fantasy of dying. It beckoned, her only real hope of escape. Then she would think about Joy, remember that she was not allowed to die, not yet. And she would scratch and cough her way back to life, Dittmars laughing all the while. She had managed to forget that, almost. The curling iron, the choking, what it was like to lie beneath a man, sex and death mingling, until it was impossible to identify which release you wanted more. It all came back to her when Kath, enraged by a simple retort, leaped at Polly, knocking her to the ground. When Kath tried to put her hands around Polly's throat, Polly felt no confusion. She knew in that moment she wanted to live by any means necessary. They rolled and grappled on the kitchen floor, equal matches. But at some point, Kath got on top and reached for her throat again. People say they see red when angry. But in Polly's memory, the room began to turn green, more of a greenish-gray yellow, the color of the sky before a late summer storm. Dots floated in front of her eyes. Unlike Dittmars, Kath wasn't going to stop in time. She wasn't even pretending to be interested in Polly's pleasure. Polly squirmed across the floor, inch by inch, until they were under her metal table. Once in the table's shadow, knowing she would have one chance, it was like holding that knife over Dittmar's chest as it rose and fell with his snores. She bucked as hard as she could, driving Kath's head into the underside of the metal table again and again. Her only thought was to dislodge her, to make her let go. But once again, Polly's aim was true. Her strength, superhuman. Kath's skull cracked on the third or fourth blow. She collapsed on Polly, heavier than the weight of any man she had ever known. Polly's first instinct was to run. She could take Kath's keys, steal her car, drive to a bus station or train station, disappear. But she would have to run forever, sacrificing her dream of a life with Joy and Janny. And it was an accident. Self-defense, not her fault. Only who would believe her? How many times is a woman allowed to defend herself? In Polly's experience, not even once. She had time, not much, but enough to calm down, make a plan. She took a shower, not worrying about the clothes she was leaving behind, the blood on the dress she'd been wearing. If her plan worked, it would take all evidence with it. If it didn't, she refused to consider that possibility. She put on her favorite dress, chose her sandals, despite knowing they were her least practical shoes. They were too pretty to lose. She fastened her rose necklace from the thrift store around her neck, only on a velvet ribbon, the better to hide the marks left by Kath's fingers. She turned on the pilot, closed the windows, left candles burning near the curtains, made sure the pink scarf on her bedside lamp was touching the bulb. If enough gas built up before the fire got going, nothing would be left standing. And nothing was. Except Polly. She should have gone to Reno, after all. Might have cost her Adam. But it would have saved his life. She shouldn't have wound Greg up like a top, knowing he would come spinning right at her. She never planned to shoot him. Or did she? She wanted only to provoke him into crossing some line, proving that he was the unfit parent. It's hard to remember all her beautiful plans, which ones worked, which ones didn't. She saved herself, she saved her daughters. Everyone else was. What was that word that Adam liked to use? Lagniappe. She is paying for her tomatoes when she hears a band at the far end of the parking lot start a familiar song. The man next to her, cute, probably 10 years younger than she is, his graying hair gathered in a short, thick ponytail, begins to croon, almost under his breath. When he sees her head jerk up in recognition, he talk-sings the words to her. I'd like to get to know you. She sees the dim interior of the hi-ho, the jukebox's tubes glowing pink and green, the sun setting and rising over the cornfields, bigger than any other sun she's ever known. An iron bed, a quilt folded over the footboard, a silk dressing gown, a metal top table, room 3 at the Valley View, a slip of green paper, the scrawled order for poached eggs and rye toast, carrying an erotic charge unlike any she had ever known or would ever know again. The summer of 1995 feels like a century ago. Last August, she took Joy and Janny to Rehoboth, ignoring the Belleville bypass and choosing the old main road, the one that goes past the hi-ho. It's a Mexican restaurant now, advertising Margarita Mondays and 2-for-Taco Tuesdays. The valley view, raised, leaving only a view of the non-valley. Mr. C died in 2002, and it's doubtful that Max and Ernest are alive, much less showing up for Margarita Mondays in a bar that's been repainted with red, white, and green stripes, the better to resemble the Mexican flag. Everybody's dead, except Polly. Ponytail smiles at her, pulls out his cell phone and offers its blank text screen to Polly. Give him your digits, Janny would say if she were here. What could it hurt? Oh, honey, if only you knew. I really would like to get to know you, he says, with the confidence born of never being turned down. Polly shakes her head, glad for the dark glasses that hide her eyes. Trust me, you wouldn't. Polly drives home to the perfect house, with the two perfect daughters. Yes, both perfect. Anyone who doesn't see their individual perfection is dead to her. Who will never know, must never know, what their mother did to provide them with their happy lives. The summer sky is a cloudless blue that seems hundreds of miles away, a towering ceiling, out of reach, higher than any bird or plane could fly. You could even say, it arches. This is Susan Bennett. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Sunburn, a novel by Laura Lippman. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Katie Ostroka. Text copyright 2018 by Laura Lippman. Production copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.